Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This special program was brought to you by TechServe, New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and service provider, serving creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe has built a solid reputation in their expertise in technology, sales, and service. Visit them on the web at techserve.com or in New York City at 119 West 23rd Street. Learn more about their in-store classes and incredible insider program. Make stuff happen. TechServe.
When I was a kid, I focused more on the skies at night, and now I'm paying more attention to things that are a little closer to home. The more you understand about your techniques and about your ingredients, the more you can think sort of in the abstract, well, what can I do with these things that hasn't been done before?
HeritageRadioNetwork.org presents Evolutionaries. Harold McGee is a world-renowned author, scientist, and one of the undisputed leaders of the modernist cuisine movement. He literally wrote the book on food science. His most famous work, On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen, is one of the most highly regarded texts on cooking to ever be published. McGee has written for Nature, Health, The New York Times, The World Book Encyclopedia, and at symposiums and universities across the world. He originally attended the California Institute of Technology to study astronomy and physics.
When I had the idea of writing about science, I then, of course, looked to see, well, what kind of science should I write about? Can I write about? And the first thing that occurred to me was to write about astronomy, because that's the subject that I had loved so much and went off to school to study. But it quickly became clear to me that there were plenty of people writing really good books about astronomy and the origins of the universe and big questions like that. Similarly, there were a lot of people writing about biology and about medicine. So I kept looking and looking and thinking and thinking and realized that no one was really writing about everyday life, the sorts of experiences that we have every day and that are also informed by the nature of the physical universe, but that we just don't think of in that way. And so I began to think, well, maybe I could write a book about the science of everyday life, and thought about gardening, thought about the weather, and then cooking occurred to me, food and cooking occurred to me, and immediately was appealing because that's something that both gives us pleasure every day and that many of us actually practice every day. We actually manipulate and transform foods when we make coffee or when we make a dinner. And so it's something participatory in a way that, for example, learning about the weather there wouldn't be that same kind of active involvement because you just suffer it. You may understand it better, but there's nothing you can do about it. So I was telling my friends in the literature department about this idea of mine, and I had a friend from New Orleans who immediately piped up when I mentioned this idea of writing about the science of food, and he said, okay, if you're going to write about the science of food, I've got a question for you, and that question is, why do beans give you gas? Because I love red beans and rice, and I can only afford to have one serving, otherwise I really suffer. And so I want to know, what's going on? Can I substitute red beans with something else and not suffer as much and have seconds? I want to understand the science of flatulence. And everybody cracked up, me included, but I immediately thought, you know, that's a great question. And I, for the first time, went off to the library, the biology library at this university, to see if I could find the answer to his question. It was a very motivating question. And went to the library, discovered not only that people do study flatulence, and in fact, much of the research had been funded by NASA, because they were concerned about air quality in confined spaces. Not only did that research exist, but I could answer his question. What is it about beans that causes that problem, and which beans cause more problems than other beans? And so there was a practical solution to his question. And that example of a question that was a good question, a fundamental question, and an entertaining and funny question altogether made me realize that this was a great subject, and that really, again, motivated me to take the idea seriously and write a proposal for a book.
Harold McGee's groundbreaking book on food and science went on to become a kitchen classic. It was the how and why behind food and cooking. It's been described by Alton Brown as the Rosetta Stone of the culinary world. Daniel Ballou called the book a must-have for every cook who possesses an inquiring mind.
This was back in the 1970s. Before the internet and search and things like that. So back then, if you wanted to write a book about a subject and you didn't really know the subject that well, you basically went to a library that had a collection in that subject area, and you just kind of sat there with stacks of books and journals at your table, and you plowed through them. And that's essentially what I did. I'd never spent time in that part of the university library, and so I just had to familiarize myself with what was there and what kinds of questions I could ask that could also be answered. The question about beans was my entree, but then there were all these other subjects. Milk is dairy science and dairy technology, and that's a different area with its own set of basic texts and ongoing research journals and things like that. So what I basically did was write an overall outline, reminding myself of all the different food groups and the kinds of things that I should cover. And then I chose to start with meat because I thought that might be a subject of more general interest and immediate interest than a lot of other things, partly because it's so easy to get meat wrong. And so understanding how meat is cooked, what conditions give you a good result, what conditions give you a bad result, understanding that would be something that I thought many people would be interested in. And that's where I started, was with a sample chapter that would be devoted to meat. And that turned out to be a great choice because in the process of reading up on it, it occurred to me to ask, when did our standard way of cooking meat change, or how did the standard ways of cooking meat evolve? And so that took me back in time looking at cookbooks of past centuries to see, you know, how did people used to cook meat, and or do we do it any differently now than we did before? And in the process of looking at that, I discovered that in fact our standard way of cooking meat did change drastically in the middle of the 19th century. And the traces of that still existed in 1970s magazines and books and so on. The idea that searing a piece of meat seals in its juices, and so you should cook meat at a very high temperature to begin with and then turn the heat down and cook it more gently after that, and that somehow locked the juices into the meat. That was an idea that was proposed by a particular person at a particular time, and it swept the professional and kind of home cooking literatures and transformed the way people cook. And it turns out to be wrong, that idea. So discovering that little story turned out to be really important because when I had my first meeting with a publisher, I was just talking with him about interesting things that I was finding, and this particular story was one of them. And at the end of the lunch, he said, I love this idea, and I think I would like for our company to publish your book, but one condition will be that when you write it, I don't want it to be just sort of the scientific facts of cooking. I want you to tell those stories about how we came to cook things in a particular way, how cultures developed standard ways of handling ingredients. And that was great for me because it gave me a license to do what, as I say, I love doing, which is immersing myself in a subject and a history in the library and just trying to put together a rounded picture of how things developed.
The food world wasn't ready for Harold's ideas at the time On Food and Cooking was published in 1984. It wasn't until a review from Mimi Sheridan at Time that the book got the attention it deserved.
The approach that I took, the science of food and cooking, at the time, and this is now the early 80s when the book came out, was weird. You know, people weren't used to thinking of food and cooking in that way, and so what little publicity I got was mainly focused on the weirdness of it. And I would be asked to pose, you know, with a bunch of whipped egg whites in a funnel on top of a beaker or something like that, to just have fun with the idea of the kitchen being a laboratory. But the book itself, the substance of it, really wasn't taken that seriously. It didn't really get reviewed for quite a while, and it just kind of sat there. And that was very disappointing. My publisher said, well, you know, maybe we'll sell a few hundred copies to libraries, and then lots of people will see it that way. So it really was very disappointing to begin with. After about a year, there was something that kind of changed things, and that was a review by Mimi Sheridan in Time magazine. And I remember getting a phone call from her. She introduced herself and said she had a few questions to ask me about my book. And because it had been treated as such an oddball thing up to that point, I thought, oh boy, here we go. You know, someone who's respected authority on cooking is really going to tear it down. But instead, she wrote a very positive review for Time magazine and called it a minor masterpiece, and that really turned things around. And then I started to hear from people in the business that it was a useful resource for them, and that developed into the book kind of becoming a handbook for professional cooks.
In the wake of Harold's scientific contributions to the food world, the term molecular gastronomy has been tossed around to describe the knowledge-driven cooking that's taken over the culinary world. Harold McGee remembers how that phrase came to be, at a time when avant-garde and modernist cooking had hardly been explored.
Molecular gastronomy took on the connotations it has today, I think, accidentally. It started actually with a cooking teacher in Berkeley, California, whose name has kind of slipped out of the consciousness of people who are interested in molecular gastronomy or modernist cuisine or experimental cooking or whatever name we choose to call the sort of cutting-edge modern approach to food. Elizabeth Thomas was her name. She was a cooking teacher here in the Bay Area, and she was married to a physicist. And so she would go to scientific conferences with him fairly regularly. And at one of those in Erice, Sicily, in the late 1980s, she had a conversation with a couple of other physicists about the way that physics and the other basic sciences could contribute to a cook's understanding of the processes that they're engaged in every day. Cooking is essentially a way of transforming matter from one thing into another thing that's more interesting and delicious and nutritious and so on. And physics is at the root of that, as it's at the root of much of what we do as humans. So she was having this conversation, and the physicists encouraged her to organize a meeting in which cooks and scientists could come together and talk with each other, because there at the time was nothing like that. So she had a couple of conversations with the people in Erice who run the scientific conference center that she was attending at that time. And they said, you know, this sounds like an interesting idea, but we would need a physicist to be in charge of the program. it was a scientific conference center, and having a cook in charge, I guess, wasn't going to fly. So she enlisted a man named Nicholas Curti, an English physicist. He was at the University of Oxford, and he was a great food lover who, in fact, had done a couple of BBC television programs about the science of cooking as far back as 1969. And he had the credentials to organize a course like that at the conference center. And so she convinced him to kind of lead the institutional aspect of putting this meeting together. And then she came home to the Bay Area, and I'd known her for a few years, and she called me up and said, "We're going to put this meeting on. Would you be interested in helping us organize it?" And I said, "Of course." And then Nicholas, for his part, invited Hervé Thiesse, a French proponent of the modern approach to cooking, to be involved as well. And so Elizabeth then stepped back, and it was the three of us who organized the first meeting and in RHA in 1992. The name molecular gastronomy was invented primarily by Hervé and by Nicholas in order to deal with the conference center's desire that the name of this meeting sound distinguished and not like a cooking course. So for much of the planning process, the meeting was called the Science of Cooking, or Science and Cooking. The director of the conference center asked for something a little more impressive sounding, and so after a few iterations, and actually very late in the game, they came up with the term molecular gastronomy, which sounds very multisyllabic and grand and significant. The term molecular was chosen not because any of us at those first meetings were talking about cooking at the molecular level, because in a way it's too complicated even still to do that. It's because molecular was a kind of in term at the time, because molecular biology had been so successful in revealing what's going on in DNA, for example. So molecular was kind of in the scientific atmosphere at the time, and Hervé and Nicholas applied it to gastronomy to make this meeting sound more important than just the science of cooking. None of us, I think, had any idea that the term would stick or become a name for contemporary avant-garde cooking. And in fact, the first meetings really had nothing to do with contemporary avant-garde cooking. They were really about restaurant cooks talking with scientists, basic scientists, about traditional haute cuisine and trying to understand it better and control it better. So it really had nothing to do with the sorts of connotations that it's taken on today.
In 1995, Harold McGee was named to the James Beard Foundation's Who's Who in American Food. He consults for restaurants and manufacturers across the world. In 2008, Time magazine included him on an annual list of the world's most influential people. What started as a curiosity evolved into an iconic career.
Well, when I was growing up, of course, food was important and I loved it. But I grew up in the Midwest in the 50s and 60s and had, for the most part, a fairly ordinary middle American diet, with one exception, and that is that my mother was born and raised in India and is part Indian. So we would have Indian meals every once in a while, and I could always tell when that was happening because walking home from school a block away from our house, I could smell the smells of the fried spices and so on. And that was a strange smell in 1950s Chicago suburbs. And my friends would smell it also and say, "Ugh, what's that?" But my stomach would be rumbling because I knew I was ahead, and I really loved that stuff. So as I say, I didn't take a particular interest in food. I think any more than other kids would, and the excitement of food, the interest of food was very much a discovery that came actually with the decision to write the book. It's wonderful that the science of food and cooking has become so much more visible and even popular and even fashionable these days than it was back in the 70s when I started writing about it and had trouble explaining to people what I was trying to do and what the value of it might be. Now it's you don't have to make that case anymore. It's as I say, it's become a fashionable thing to do. And the problem with that is that there's a lot of writing and a lot of talking about the science of cooking that is shallow. Because it is a subject now of great general interest, there's a lot of writing about it that makes up explanations, I would say, that tells just-so stories just for the sake of having a cool story, but whether the facts are actually there to support it or not is another question. And I guess what really excites me at the moment is the number of people I see in the sciences who are taking an interest in cooking, who see it as a respectable subject, something that for many, many generations it has not been. The idea that you were a serious scientist and you were looking at food or at cooking, it just wasn't an acceptable area of study. And that's changing. And there are now people in food science departments, in chemistry departments, in microbiology departments who are taking the best that science has to offer these days and applying those methods of analysis to questions that are of interest to people who cook and people who love food, and not just to people who are manufacturing food and trying to do it more efficiently. So that, for me, is the really exciting development, that professional scientists are seeing the challenge and the excitement of understanding food and cooking better, and are, I think, going to take our understanding and multiply it by leaps and bounds over the next couple of decades. Many people who I meet and who know my work, or who correspond with me because they know my work, I think assume that because I've written this book that's sort of a compendium of information about food and cooking, assume that I know way more than I actually do. So, you wrote on food and cooking, and so you must be able to answer this question. And I do get lots and lots of questions. And I guess what I would say is that I think I do know a lot about food and cooking, but the thing that I know above all is how little I actually do know, how little we as a culture know about food and cooking, because simply they are such complex materials and the processes that we apply to them are such complex processes, and we as human beings are such complex organisms that explaining why, for example, a particular preparation of an eggplant is so delicious to so many people is something that at this point we can only really speculate about. We know lots of tantalizing things about what foods are, how cooking transforms them, how flavors are generated, how people perceive those flavors, and how different people perceive them differently. But we just know kind of little points so that we can draw a very rough sketch of what's going on. We still have so much to really understand about food and cooking and our enjoyment of those things.
This program was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org, with additional research from Leah Eden and Patrick Martins. In order of appearance, the songs used in this piece are Forever by Jerome LOL, Happy by Jerome LOL, Sad by Jerome LOL, Knife Show's remix of Coma by Paper Twin, Dawn by Jerome LOL, I Jam by Knife Show, and once more, Forever by Jerome LOL. Thanks for listening, and visit heritageradionetwork.org for all of our programming and more information.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.